Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network, and we have another podcast recommendation for you. It's Uli Bear's Think About It. On the podcast, Uli interviews all kinds of interesting people about all kinds of interesting things. He has three series that I'd highly recommend, one on free speech, another on great books, and finally, one on affirmative action. You can find Think About It on Apple Podcasts, or you can just go to Uli's website, which is ulrichbaer.com. That's ulrichbaer.com. You can download or listen to episodes there. We think this is a terrific podcast. In fact, it's so terrific that we're going to offer you a little taste of it. The episode you're about to hear is from Think About It, and I hope you enjoy it.
The political philosopher Hannah Arendt analyzed totalitarianism, fascism, and the possibilities of democracy. Her work is urgently relevant today, but no one should take pleasure in that fact. It's relevant because of the rise of populism, neo-fascism, and threats to democracy, to free speech, to a free press, to reason, and to thinking itself. But Arendt also insisted in the preface to a collection of her essays in 1968 that even in the darkest of times, we have the right to expect some illumination. I sat down with the philosopher Richard Bernstein, who teaches at the New School in New York City, and who first met Arendt in 1972. He told me about this first meeting, which he considered one of the most intellectually exciting and also erotic meetings in his life, and why she's such an important thinker today. He explains her political philosophy, her work, and makes it not relevant, but actually comprehensible to anyone who wants to listen. Willkommen, bienvenue, welcome. No, this is not cabaret, it's Think About It, a podcast about the power of ideas and how language can change the world, with Uli Bear.
I'm really happy to have you here. So, Professor Richard Bernstein, thank you for coming today.
Yes.
It's really great to have you. You've just published a short book, Why Read Hannah Arendt Now? You've done a lot of other books on American pragmatic philosophers, on Dewey, on continental philosophers. And I wanted to start out by asking you what motivated you to write the books and ask a question, why read Hannah Arendt now? Where are we now? Right. Why does her long work deserves to be not just reread, but we can think with her?
Yeah. Let me say something in a preliminary way, and then I'll answer the question of how I came to meet her. I met her in April of 1972. At that time, I was teaching at a liberal arts college, Haverford College, and I was not really interested in Hannah Arendt at that point. As a matter of fact, I was really quite hostile. I was hostile because when I read some of the things that she had to say about Marx and Hegel, I thought it was just off the wall. And I was much more interested in the Frankfurt thinkers and so. But it was a colleague of mine who invited me, her to give this a talk. And actually, the talk she gave was The Lying in Politics, this very famous talk.
The talk, Lying in Politics.
But Lying in Politics is the talk that she gave at Harvard. But she said when she came to Harvard that she wanted to meet me. I hadn't the slightest idea why she wanted to meet me. And when I can even remember, we met in a place called the Haverford Hotel at 8 o'clock. And the reason she wanted to meet me is that the editor of an early book I wrote called Praxis of Action was a friend of hers, had given her it to her. She wanted to tell me how much she appreciated and liked the book. My mindset.
You were ready and defensive.
Yeah, I was already. And that night, believe it or not, we talked from 8 o'clock to 2 o'clock in the morning. And one of the things that I've dedicated to her, I've said that it was both agonistic in the sense of argument and erotic in the sense of a very strong personal attraction. Remember, I'm just at the beginning of my career in my 40s and she's in the 60s. But that we became really close friends.
What did she like in that book of yours?
She liked that I was trying to do. Now, this is interesting. It tells something that a lot of people don't know about Hannah. Her generosity. In the book on Praxis of Action, I have only one little footnote to Hannah Arendt. Now, she could have taken the attitude, well, I've written about action and human condition. How come you didn't discuss that? That was not of any interest. She thought I was trying to do something fresh and original.
And what's the argument in the book on what is action for
in,
you?
In the book...
Because you're a philosopher by training,
now,
right?
In the book, I dealt with the themes of praxis and action in four traditions. In Marx, in existentialism, in American pragmatism, and analytic philosophy.
Okay.
But at that time, it went against the whole spirit of what American philosophers were doing. I was frequently said, you can't write a book. We talk about Marx and talk about analytic philosophy in the same book.
Right.
But, you know, I was stubborn or strong-headed enough that I did it. And in fact, I'll tell you something, then I'm going to answer your question. She wanted me to come to the new school on the basis of that book in 1972. It didn't really work out, and that was because the new school was going through a terrible period and financially and chaotic. Okay. And I was not inclined to come to New York City from Pennsylvania with four young children and a wife. 70s was not... New York was not such attractive a place. But when it didn't work out, she wrote me a wonderful letter about, you know, that she had recently read the book and she reread it, she used it in her teaching, and found that there were those who were very enthusiastic and very hostile to it. And then she said, I know this from my own experience. All academic writing, left, right, and center, is conservative by nature. Nobody wants to hear something new. I show that to all my students. And
she said all academic writing.
All academic
inherently
writing.
Inherently conservative.
It is inherently conservative in this way.
And she's at this point teaching at the new school.
She was teaching at the new school.
Regularly. Yes. She also has these guest positions. Okay.
Yes. She was hired regularly in the graduate faculty in 67. Right. And she was teaching.
So what did she think was new in your book? She must have found something new.
She was actually thought that I had a very fresh and interesting interpretation of Marx and Hegel.
Okay.
In the book. There were other aspects that she... But I think that the idea that I was not in convention, I was not identifying with any kind of school, that I was really trying to... That is, I think, what appealed to her. And then we became good friends. I mean, good friends in the sense that we met, she invited me for dinner, but we always argued. You know?
Really? That was her mode of engaging? Really, that was what she wanted?
Even in our correspondence, how to translate the word Geist. You know,
really?
I was arguing that it's better to use the term spirit in English than mind.
Right.
And so it was a wonderful friendship. In fact, in a curious way, I'm not answering. And then I will ultimately get to the question. She was responsible for the publication of my second book, which not the book I wrote after that, called The Restructuring of Social and Political Philosophy, because she asked me when I was going to the new school, when she wanted me to, what are you working on? I had just applied for an NEH grant.
Okay.
So I had a proposal. She took that proposal and showed it to her editor, William Jovanovich, who was the head of Harcourt Brace, and was very close. And the next thing I know that I'm invited, Anna asked me would I like to have go to a Sunday brunch at his estate. So I met Hannah in New York, and we drove up with Mary McCarthy. And this was all very lovely. I was a bit naive. I thought, this is nice. I'm meeting all these people.
Nice brunch.
And at the end of the brunch, he says, I'm going to publish your next book.
Oh, you didn't realize you were pitching a project.
No.
You thought you were just having brunch.
Yeah. So, and actually, Hawk Corporation did publish the book, and it was so the intervention of Anna.
And it says something interesting that she's got you in touch with a publisher of non-academic books.
Yes, that's right. What I think is the uptake of this story is Hannah could be very opinionated. And if she thought somebody was stupid or she didn't like them, she didn't hesitate.
Yeah.
But Barry is the fact that, look, I was not a known intellectual. I was a young person. That made no difference. She thought I was that I was doing interesting things.
Right.
And so she was sort of generous and friendly and helpful.
And it became a conversation.
And it became a conversation. And indeed, that's when I had to sit down and reread her work seriously, because there was the first conference ever on Hannah Arendt was in 1972 in November, the following November.
Yeah.
After I had met her. So I sat down, read her work, and I gave a paper. And she came to it. She was at the conference. And that was also interesting. Because, you know, people giving things, naturally you're going to say nice things about Hannah. She wasn't interested in that. She was interested in the issues. That's what she wanted to discuss.
It's interesting. There's what you said, there's a generosity.
Yes.
And you also form a lot of, there's a kind of impatience with wasting time with academic debates.
I think there is. I mean, one of the illusions, you know, Hannah Arendt is, I still haven't answered your question, but I will. Hannah Arendt was, you know, people associated with the New School, and she did teach at Princeton, and she did teach at Berkeley, but she was never an academic.
Right.
She really was an independent thinker. And even when she taught, it's only in 67, after all, she was born like that, she really took a regular position.
Right.
And even there, she would take off time to write. So she was always, you know, writing and thinking and lecturing. But never, she actually thought the American academic institutions were a very funny and peculiar institution. She was invited, I think, to be a visiting professor at Princeton. She was the first woman. She got publicly interviewed. How does it feel to be the first woman professor at Princeton? And she said, I don't know. I've always been a woman.
She didn't. That's another question she really liked to answer. She got asked that several times, right?
So in writing this book, I've been dealing with Hannah's work, sometimes I'm very critical.
Mm-hmm.
There are many things that I'm very critical of in it, and I've written a number of papers, but it's always been in conversation and engagement with her. Mm-hmm. And I did write this book on Hannah Arendt and Jewish question.
Right.
And as you well know, particularly after the Trump election, I mean, there was just this interest in her, and now, till today, she's all over the social media, there are articles. The books are selling more than anything else. And the editor of Polity told me that there was a small... So this book was written for a very specific audience.
Okay.
It was written for the people who are not necessarily academics and so forth, but who've heard the name and really want to know something about her. It's a book without footnotes and a scholarly apparatus, and it's meant to be read in an evening or a day or two or on a plane from here to L.A.
Yeah. Well, and it tells a story. I think there's a story of how she becomes a political thinker and what it means to actually be politically engaged. I've seen you give a talk somewhere else where she said all of our thought, all of our thinking has to be rooted in the incidents of lived experience.
Yeah.
She's now such a guide for everybody. People turn to her and say, she can give us some wisdom. That is not her approach. She said, I can help you maybe.
No, that's clear.
Think through what is going
on. She would be scandalized by the idea of Arendtians.
Right.
You know, it is certainly true. And, you know, people will speak about her theory of evil, her theory of politics. That's already on the wrong side. I mean, if you really take her seriously, she is engaged in the project of thinking and rethinking, coming at something from one point of view, from another point of view, and you have to take her in that way. I mean, in the beautiful portrait of Socrates in an essay called Thinking of Moral Consideration, she raises the question, how do you teach someone to think? You infect them with your own perplexities.
You infect them with your own perplexities.
Perplexities. And I think that that's the way it is. I mean, you're not going to find solutions to things. I mean, it's perplexities and problems that she's always seeing.
Do you think she had the confidence that everybody has that capacity?
Yes.
everybody could be taught or activated.
Yes,
or encouraged
to think. I mean, that is extraordinarily important for her because she takes up the topic. She was always interested in thinking, but thinking is not knowledge, and thinking is like, she uses a beautiful metaphor of Penelope's web. You have to weave it and then unweave it again. And she would say that there are no dangerous thoughts. All thinking is dangerous because it's always questioning, it's always loosening.
And it's interesting that this is a central concern for her. Yeah. What is thinking? It's not technical, problem solving, puzzles solving. Well, it starts from there that then she says, what is the political space? But individuals, we have a capacity to think.
Yes.
We also have a capacity for thoughtlessness.
Yes.
For actually using concepts that we've inherited.
As the way she once put it, very sort of cryptic. Thinking is dangerous, but non-thinking is more dangerous.
Non-thinking is more dangerous. Tell me something. What do you think she meant by non-thinking?
As I say, you can find the theme of thinking in her earliest work on. It becomes more thematic as a result of the Eichmann book.
Yeah.
Because her hypothesis is that Eichmann lacked a certain capacity to think. Now, people find that mystifying. I mean, Eichmann was intelligent. He could manage things beautifully. He was a wonderful bureaucrat. But thinking for her is, in that context, is having the capacity to really be imaginative and to understand things from another point of view. In this context, you know, her reflections and Kant's reflective judgment were very important. So there is that aspect of thinking. And so that's what it is. She asked herself, what is it that he lacked, that is her own suggestion? And that then led her to a much more systematic trying to understanding. She loved the English expression, stop and think. You know, when you stop and think, and how few people.
Like check in with yourself.
Yes.
So she kind of says academic work doesn't really produce novel. Let's just keep that on the side. And to go back to the...
Yeah.
So she writes the book on totalitarianism where there's a large section on that people slowly are taught not to think, but accept stories and concepts and paradigms that are given to them, and they see themselves in that way. It's not like they see the outside world, but they start seeing themselves, let's say, as resistors or complicit.
Yes.
She goes to Jerusalem to document the trial for the New Yorker.
Yeah.
She's a journalist, really, and there's a certain, when you read the letters, there's a certain kind of mixture of excitement and saying, I'm just going to report on this. And then something happens to her when she witnesses this trial, because Eichmann is on the stand and he produces enormous, absurd amounts of documentation and justification and reasoning and explanations. None of this for her is then thinking.
No. Right? In fact, this is what most impressed her in the testimony, that he is so caught up in clichés, in bureaucraties, that he could never break out of it. She was fascinated, not only his language at the report, but she read, there was this whole pre-trial thing, as if it's almost a machine just doing and then preventing him from really sort of thinking. So that's
But as you said before, very successful. Someone can learn how to speak in a very
efficient, successful. I mean, after all, he was a genius in figuring out how to get people to the death camps.
So say something about that, what she experiences. She's witnessing somebody who's very good at explaining and she wants to say there's another way of thinking, to stop and think. So what is this other way?
The point is to stop and think, to reflect on what you're doing and doing, to question your biases and your prejudices. It's so interesting. In the essay on thinking and more, I think when she says, I'm going to look for an exemplar of the thinking that everybody can engage in, an exemplar of Socrates. She says, a citizen who's not a philosopher.
Yeah,
and it's the questioning. She takes up the metaphors that Plato uses, that he is a gadfly, that there's a reality that he brings, but most of the ideas that he brings out in other people, she says, are wind eggs.
Right.
And then he has the capacity to paralyze. It's like a stingray. And what she means by that is not that thing, but to touch you in a way that really sort of infects you in some ways.
Right. Yeah. When she talks about Socrates and Plato, they become quite important in the context of what independent thinking could be for a person versus
my personal opinion, which is in between Socrates and Plato, there's this, you have an opinion, I have an opinion, we all have opinions.
Let me say this. Hanno is tremendously erudite, but there are ways in which when she speaks about figures, philosophers, from an academic point of view, you can say, wait a minute, she doesn't have it quite right. But she thinks about them creatively.
Yeah.
In other words, if you take her on Kant on reflective judgment, any student who took a course in Kant at the graduate course would say, this isn't really what Kant is doing. It's not so interesting. It's a little bit like Carol Bloom's idea of systematic misreading.
Right.
What is brilliant is what she's doing with it.
So let's say what Bloom means maybe is that you are touched by what the person says.
Yes.
But you also activate something in that.
Precisely.
In, which is now a corpus and a name, and there's Kant, and you can get Kant right. She would say, I'm not about to get right. It's not quite the criteria, right?
Perfect description.
So what does she get from these people?
I mean, I think it's a stroke of genius to see that what Kant was doing with aesthetic judgment, she sees as essentially political. That's the key to understanding political, because you need a form of judgment which is not simply deductive, not simply determinate, where you're facing the particular and looking. So it is a kind of brilliant insight and a brilliant appropriation. I want to get back to the Plato, because she frequently stresses the difference between Plato and Socrates.
Right.
She has a quarrel with philosophy. I mean, she thinks that what the tradition of philosophy from Plato to Hegel and Marx is not really interested in politics as his practice, but imposing philosophic standards on it. And in that sense, it distorts politics, because politics is for her the realm of opinion, of doxa, of testing things that in the public space in which rational truth or philosophic truth is not appropriate.
But that's interesting. So actually she has a quarrel with Plato.
Yes.
Who hesitates but says ultimately we must find a truth. And she says that could become a tyrannical imposition.
Exactly. She even has an expression at times, the coercion of truth, you see.
But it's interesting. She opens up this category of truth.
Yeah.
But to something else, what you said, there's opinion, we all have opinions. Political space for her is not to find the truth with a capital T.
Right.
Right? There's a conflict.
Right.
Although we would think today, I'd like to have the truth. I'd like to not live in a country of lies.
Arendt is a great distinction maker. Sometimes people find it frustrating because she's using words in unusual ways.
Right.
Take, for example, action. Well, I mean, we're acting all the time.
Right.
Action is something really quite specific for her in terms of public action. So you have to be sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
But what she's trying to elicit, I mean, much of my book is an attempt, not only is one of my favorite passages of how all thinking is rooted in experience and has to be brought back to experience, but one of the things that makes her, I think, Arendt such an interesting and exciting thinker. I mean, when I teach Arendt, always there are some students who come alive, and there is a reason for that. Arendt is, you could agree or disagree with her. And she was always controversial, not just in Eichmann, all the way through her life, when she wrote about Brecht, when she wrote about segregation. She had that capacity to touch nerves that people feel strong, and that's part of her provocativeness. But she is an exemplar of a person who is tremendously sophisticated in philosophy, in political science, in literature, but using it all the time to deal with real problems.
Right.
Problems of refugees, problems of statelessness, problems of lying.
The race problem in America.
And race,
the problem of justice. The Eichmann trial is ultimately for her a problem of who can pass judgment on what happened in one country a long time ago.
But also so that she is the paradigm of what many people think an intellectual should be, and where academics really are. You know, we really are the kinds of people who are taking what we know and applying it to the vital issues of our time.
So when you said she uses words sometimes against the grain or against established usage, when she talks about the truth, she says Plato knows of this risk that the philosopher's truth will be a coercion or imposition on the life of people in the world.
Yeah.
And Socrates says, I have to elicit not my just personal opinion, but my capacity to make sense of myself.
Well, this is where you have to sort of appreciate, for example, what she's doing with a concept like opinion. all mm-hmm. the thing. Opinion for her is not just my opinion.
Right.
Opinion is something that is really sort of tested in the public space where you come up with it, but it never makes the claim to any kind of absolute certainty or absolute
right.
truth.
Right.
Truth is relevant to opinion. It's got to be based on it, but you have to make a distinction. And she sees it as an enormous... Now, I think what we haven't introduced that is was so important for her in the lying is she wants to make the distinction between rational truth.
Yeah.
That's like truths of mathematics, or what she sometimes used, the truths that Plato are claiming that we know when we know the forms, and factual truth.
Okay.
And the reason that factual truth is the problem, the main problem for us today, is because it's contingency. Any factual truth could be otherwise. Therefore, you have a greater capacity to destroy it. And she thinks of the rewriting of history.
Right.
She thinks, and that lying for her is a deliberate attempt to destroy factual truth.
So in this interesting essay, which now has this kind of renaissance, he
yes.
said 1972, it's truth in politics.
Yeah.
She says, lying has always been part of politics. Actually, opening is really
yes.
startling. She
yes.
says, people lie in politics. I mean,
yes.
we are living
right.
in America right now, and our attorney general just lied to Congress. And she
yeah.
said, well, lying is always part of it. No one has ever had a problem with it.
Yeah.
But something shifts, what you just said, when
right.
factual truth is not just we negotiate, and ultimately...
Right.
Ultimately, we know to negotiate
right.
and come maybe to an agreement, tenuous
yeah.
or not. But she says there's something else going on. And this is after the Pentagon Papers.
Yes.
She said, what is introduced? You make a point of this. She is always very interested in what's the new thing? What's
yes.
novel here?
Well, one of the things that was, I want to make 2 points. Sometimes I say I want to make 2 points.
And
it
make,
turned out to be four.
Okay.
or
well,
some
we can
more,
do that.
more. She wrote that essay. She was provoked to write that essay after the Eichmann book. Because she thought that there were all kinds of lies.
So just give me one sentence. The Eichmann book caused a fury of responses.
Yes.
Because
yes.
what was the main argument that people made? What was,
well,
wrong?
I think
what was
that,
wrong with that book?
I think that there were many, many things that were wrong. Many kinds of objections. It was primarily an American Jewish community that reacted strong. There are a few pages in which he discusses the what were called the Judenrat, the Jewish councils, which was an issue that nobody really wanted to publicly discuss. The truth is that what the Nazis did in ghettos and places, get various Jewish leaders to organize their own kinds of communities.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the truth is that this is a very complex issue. There were members of Jewish councils who committed suicide rather than follow
right.
Nazi
right.
orders. There were others who used it for power and aggrandizement and so forth. But I think that then and still, people like to think in two simple categories. There are victims and perpetrators. They're the
right.
bad guys and the rest are innocent.
Right. Right.
And I think that what Arendt says, first of all, it isn't the truth. You have to understand the extent to which successful totalitarian can get people to be their own kind. So we know that most of the dirty work in the concentration camps were done by members in the concentration, even running the gas chambers.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But this, I think in 19, it was scholars knew about this and people who had functioned in them, but it was not something to be discussed.
And then she's writing it in the
and
New Yorker.
And then she just mentions it and that was explosive because that was then interpreted, she's blaming the victim, which he was not doing.
So she was accused of blaming the victim
yes.
and of being too soft, because the banality of evil is the
yeah.
catchphrase, and she
yeah,
says
and,
you are downplaying
right.
the perpetrator.
Right, and that was, again, because that really is an enormous distortion. I
yeah.
mean, when she says, I quote her, the deeds were monstrous,
right.
but the man was not a monster.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
we still
yeah.
think that way.
Yeah.
We still think in terms of our own politics, of how we thought of Osama, they are the personification of evil, just like in the bad guys in Western movies.
Right.
That's
right.
Bush used that analogy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that the deeper point of Arendt, and even in that book, if you want to understand evil after totalitarianism, you can't understand it in that way. And you have to understand how people who could be just normal, successful, middle,
right.
but put in certain situations,
they'll do terrible
could do
things, terrible
monstrous
things.
Things.
Yeah. So that is actually, and then
so
this
the
is,
banality doesn't refer to the what was done. It refers to the set, the mental set of a person. You know, look, I send cattle, I send humans to their death.
Right.
What's the difference? That's where it is. When you get into that kind of, and people think that way. She says another wonderful statement. Most of the evil in this world is not done by people who think they're doing evil.
Then
they don't really stop and think about what they're doing.
Or they're doing something.
But people don't want to hear that.
It's interesting.
I mean, you know, Eichmann had to be a monster. Eichmann had to be sadistic. Mm. You know, Eichmann was embodied anti-Semitism from Pharaoh to the present.
So do you think the criticism of the book is about the argument? It's also about the tone.
Yes.
Because she uses, and you mentioned this in the book, she uses irony.
Yes.
Which in this context is very hard to stomach.
Yes.
And I think people were that you're using the wrong tone. But I think Hannah Arendt never shrunk away from using irony.
No. And she says something quite explicitly. She said when she was reading it, she says this in the famous Gauss interview, that I laughed many times when I listened to him. I myself do think that there are parts that she should have at least been more sensitive to the fact that this is still a very painful time for Holocaust survivors, you know. Even, for example, in the beginning of the book, she's very critical of Ben-Gurion. You're not going to win friends. Ben-Gurion was considered like, you know, a hero, Mandela at this time. You're not going to win friends when you begin a book and talk about the show trial.
Right, but I think she didn't even respect for the feelings of survivors or their experiences. She thought there was a piety we can't afford. She says at some point, we can't afford any pieties here. We have to be just so clear. And she says, I have to just do this work. And I think she felt herself.
Well, there's always, by the way, there is an interesting earlier fact that I discovered only much later. You know that Hannah Arendt, when she fled to Germany in 1933, she spent the time in France.
Right.
And just before the Germans invaded France, the French authorities put all German emigres, that is mainly Jews, into internment camps. In fact, she once made this wonderful remark. She said, you know, we happen to be a new kind of people, the people where our enemies put us in concentration camps and our friends put us in internment camps. She says that, and we refugees. But she was in Gurs, which was a camp for women near the Spanish border. And when the Nazis marched into France, there was a period of chaos, and she escaped from it.
Yeah.
The women who did not escape from there were ultimately sent to Auschwitz by Otto Feichmann. So when she goes to Sean and says that I want to confront this and the thing, you might say it at a much deeper level was this kind of knowledge that by the grace of fate, she could have been sent to Auschwitz by Eichmann.
There's this outrageous response, outraged response to Eichmann.
Yes.
And in another interview, she said, something shifted. She said, when we learned what happened there, something shifted.
Well, that's not just about Eichmann. That was that there was a period in the early 40s when they were hearing about the extermination, not just concentration camps. They didn't believe it. She didn't believe it at first. This is exaggeration. Mm-hmm. And then that's when things shifted. When it came, this is already, I think, in early 42, this is something she said should not have happened.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This becomes a basis for what she says that people can be declared to not have a right to exist on the planet. Yes. That must not happen.
Well, that's...
She says it's outside of legal categories, right, that and becomes, depriving them of their rights.
And that's also fundamental to, I mean, one of the reasons why Arendt, I think, is... Let me say a little bit more generally what I tried to do in this book. I wanted to tell the story. I wanted to give a kind of range of her thinking. But she was extraordinarily perceptive about what she calls the darkness of the times. And the darkness does not refer just to totalities. It relates to lying, the denigration of truth, or that wonderful statement when in the name of moral uplifting, all truth gets denigrated to triviality. The most frightening sentence in The Origins of Totalitarianism, which is a book she writes in the 50s, is she says that totalitarian methods will well persist when totalitarian regimes fall. Mm. We think of torture and genocide and the kinds of things. So when you see what's going on today, I mean, Honor would never say that we're living in a totalitarian society, but so many of the tendencies that she saw that ultimately crystallized are with us today. Yeah.
So she writes this essay in 72 after having gone through this experience of writing a book that was experienced as an outrageous provocation by so many. She was pretty isolated then in a way, in some circles, right, in New York City. Yeah. So in 72, she takes us up to write about truth and politics.
Yes.
So there's a background, because it starts out by on the Pentagon Papers and all that. But what is she trying to...
Well, told you the immediate provocation was the Eichmann book. And now, for Arendt, you see, she wasn't just going to write the answer to her critics. But it raises deep issues about it indeed. Now, I think we haven't yet mentioned what I think is the most, how can I put it, revealing and scariest part of what she has to say. Because she talks about lying as a form of action, which is destructive, and she makes the point how successful it can be. She also makes the point about, in terms of propaganda, I mean, it's related to fact-checking today, that people are not interested in the facts. They want a story. They want a narrative, you know, to speak to their anxieties and things, so that many liberals, I think, are sort of distressed. How come when we point out all the facts that are wrong, people are not interested? She understood the propaganda, how it works. But she makes a further point, which is really, I think, she says it can come a point where the very distinction between truth and falsity gets lost. That's really the, and I sometimes think, not just in the Trump administration, but in what's happening with new authoritarianism, that's the scary thing. I mean, I really do think, I mean, it's my own personal opinion, there's one form of lying when you know you're lying. You know the truth, but there's a form of lying where you're not even aware.
You don't know anymore.
The thing, and that, I think, is a serious day, and I think we see this in our time.
And she says then it becomes the reality.
Yes.
Right? People actually believe this is what happened.
Yeah.
And they keep on referring to it. And she says that is propaganda that's so effective that people are deprived of this capacity to stop and think.
Oh, not only stop and think, but they don't even see that there's a distinction between truth and falsity. That's the sense in which she says that there's always been lying. It means about diplomacy and secretness and not telling the truth. But what's new...
Right.
Is the destruction of the very capacity, because after a traditional lie, you know the truth and you're telling something which is not the truth.
And
you're still making the distinction between truth and falsity. You're just using it for various purposes.
So you're making the distinction and saying, you can still say, while you believe in a total falsehood, you say, this is false, this is true, so you keep on talking a language of truth.
Plato gives a good example. I mean, I can know that this is a horse, but I'm going to convince you it's a mule. But I know it's a horse.
Right.
But what happens when you don't even see that anymore?
Right.
That's what's really dangerous.
So in this essay, Truth and Politics, which has gotten some attention now again, she says the U.S. government is doing something different.
Well, that, I think, is something that really became very striking to her from the Pentagon Papers. The new form of lying, it was image making. Not only did the Pentagon Papers reveal that the government was systematically lying, but what were the reasons for perpetuating the war? It wasn't economic advantage. It wasn't the defeat of communism. It was the image. America cannot be seen as losing a war. Mm-hmm. When that begins to happen, and now she then talks about how much lie has got to do with image making.
Right.
And that she thought was a new form of lying.
Do you think she would have a sense that that crisis was then averted when Nixon resigned? Does our country get back in order or on course at that point?
She leaves us with an ambiguity. I mean, it's one of her perplexities. On the one hand, there's a very powerful argument that lying can destroy factual truth. On the other hand, she ends it by defending the universities and defending the vehicles. So there is the idea it becomes a greater obligation for there still to be the truth seekers and people to stand up. She did think that the university is one of the last institutions where this could be done. And that's what it is. But, you know, but you will see both. But yes, you could say, Hannah, yeah, that's important. It's crucial. But you're also giving an argument that it can be destroyed. And I think that's one of the perplexities she leaves us with.
I want to ask you something about this claim she makes about the universities. In this essay, she says, the universities have to be actually a non-politicized space.
Yes.
Which she is teaching in the universities in the late 60s.
Yeah.
And she's saying the universities are becoming politicized by outside forces.
Yeah.
She takes a very strong stance against Black studies.
Yes.
Very controversial.
Right.
And basically says what we would call affirmative action today, it's admitting unqualified students.
Well, she does say that.
So all of these criticisms are about political events.
Right.
But she wants to preserve something, and I'm curious whether this idea that there is a space that's not politicized, whether that's actually, you can maintain that.
One of the other interesting statements about Hannah, at this conference in 1972, Hans Morgenthau asked her this question.
So Hans Morgenthau, as you said, he's one of the people who resigned from the government, correct?
No. Hans Morgenthau was actually a professor of political theory.
And I think he wasn't.
He did.
He was in the administration, in the government, and he resigned from the government and then became a professor.
But he was a very good friend.
Yeah.
And he said to her, in almost this language, because I was there, Hannah, what are you? Are you conservative? Are you a liberal? Where do you stand?
Right.
And this is the way she answered. She said, you know, the people on the left accuse me of being conservative. The people on the right think I'm a kind of radical. In effect, she says, I couldn't care less. It's the thing she says that's next that I thought was so interesting. And you know, Hans, I don't think that the primary issues of our time are going to be answered in those terms. Okay? Now, there are passages in Arendt where if you want to, take it out of context. She's an elitist. She's a conservative. She doesn't understand what's going on in America. And there are other passages. After all, she's defending the revolutionary spirit.
Right.
She's certainly not a liberal she favors the council system that you could read the other. She really was independent, you see. And so I do think, though, and I think you can argue with her, I think that what she was afraid of, and I think that the institutions would become completely ideological. And if they're academic, then they would lose their soul.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
She also had rather, quote, a conservative attitude towards schools and young children. They should not be used for political purposes.
Right.
That's part of what she objected to in Little Rock, and that they have to be preserved. Politics is only when you are mature enough.
Let's talk about that for a moment. She writes an essay on Little Rock, on the integration of the schools, the desegregation after Brown versus Board of Education.
No.
She takes a very strong sense and says the government should not impose integration.
Legally. Yeah, right.
Okay.
Right.
From today's perspective, I think she's entirely wrong. It's quite interesting what she says, what you just said about school should not be a place where politics intervene.
Right.
I always thought this is the one time when Hannah Arendt is corrected, when Ralph Waldo Emerson writes and says, you don't understand.
Yeah.
The life of an African-American family in America, they're not using their kids, but their kids are already politicized in the system.
Yes.
And she says, in response to this, this is one of the few, I don't know, you knew her, but it seems to be one of the very few moments where
she admitted she was wrong.
She was wrong, right.
But the interesting thing, and this also tells something about Hannah, Ellison made this remark in an interview with Robert Penn Warren. She read it. She took the initiative to write to him and to said, that I, you're right, I didn't really understand.
Interesting.
So that is, I mean, you know, some people would then argue that it wasn't a public statement, but that tells something about Hannah, you know, that she could recognize. I mean, I think it's a terrible essay, and I think it's an essay in which many of the things that she objected to were illustrated. What I mean by that is she objected to people not really grasping the particular but imposing their own categories. This is a very time in which she's developing the categories of the political, the social, and the private,
right,
and they really do not work in this situation. Right. So that, in a way, if there is an exemplar in Arendt of bad judgment, this is it.
Of imposing her categories,
yes,
onto the particular.
That's right. I point this out in my book, but I would be much harder on this. I did not get into the book, which is a major topic, is the way she draws the distinction between the social and the political, which I think ultimately, I've written criticizing her, this distinction just is really misleading.
Yeah. Which I think was my question a little bit, that there could be a space that's not politicized.
Well, right. To liken the form of discrimination where if I'm a Jew and I want to go to a hotel with their only Jews, to discrimination of what's going on with blacks in America is, you know, to be blind to a tremendous difference.
Well, the difference maybe the question of power. So in some ways, when she says, I want to go to a hotel and only be with other Jews, that's fine. Yeah. So I have no problem with other people going to a hotel where there are no Jews. If you're living in an unequal society where power is unequally distributed, then that's different.
Well, power in that sense. Yeah, remember that power also is a complex notion in Arendt.
Right.
We can think of power in terms of power over and the forms of abuse, the suffering, the sacrifice that goes on. To me, there's an enormous irony about this, and I'll tell you what the irony is. Because, you know, the origins of totalitarianism was not to be about totalitarianism. Right. It was to be about imperialism and racism. And she has a tremendous, she's very insightful about the origin of racism, particularly biological, is it ideology. So there are a lot of resources in Arendt where she could have been much more sensitive to what was going on.
This argument, that's the first part of what becomes the origin of totalitarianism. It's an examination of racism, imperialism, anti-Semitism. Right. And she says, it's not an irrational disgust or feeling, it's an ideology.
Yes.
Right? And this is actually quite interesting at what you're saying, that she understands it from the beginning in these political terms.
Yeah.
And she wants to remove it from the sphere of this is just an emotional response that we can't do anything about.
Right. She never would accept that.
That is actually a really important insight because we're living in a time right now where people say, oh, some people, they're just how they feel and this is just, we can't get rid of it.
No. Here is where you're right. And I don't think she would object to it, that you have to use Arendt sometimes to think against Arendt.
Against herself, right.
I think there are people who are so enamored with her that they want to defend every word. I've actually had the experience where, as I say, from the 70s, I've been arguing with her.
Yeah.
But you know, when you have her, and this is what's so exciting, I think, about Arendt and rereading her, I always see something new. Something that is, I think, either insightful or wrong. And so it is an ongoing conversation.
When I look at the early works, there's this kind of analysis of totalitarianism, of political regimes, of people losing the capacity to be independent free agents.
Yeah.
And then in the books on revolution, the early 60s, she writes about the French and the American Revolution.
Yeah.
It's this very celebratory book, I think, of America.
Absolutely.
I think it's really a turn to America.
Yeah.
Freedom becomes a category, and she says, and you quote this in your book, that people, even in the worst circumstances, can retain some capacity of their own, and I don't know what to call it, independence or agency or freedom. So how does that manifest itself in these dark times that she
You see, this is the play of darkness and illumination. I mean, the darkness is detecting tendencies in what you would sometimes call the modern world, the modern age, which haven't left us. And we're there, and to use a metaphor, she like crystallized into totalitarianism and are still with us. The illumination is in terms of her deep conception about what we are as human beings, about the ideas of natality, that we have capacity to new beginning, and that the new beginning is really also the basis for a kind of freedom. And my reading of Arendt is that what really led to her positive conception of politics mm-hmm. was Twilling of the Horrors of Totalitarianism. Mm-hmm. Because her deepest insight about totalitarianism is not just massacres and numbers of people that they're killing, but the attempt to destroy the human capacity for spontaneity to initiate. And that now becomes, you might say, the motif of the positive conception that we are, each of us is born anew, and she liked to use the term natality, not born, but second borning. There can always be, against all the odds, new beginnings. And that's the way she sees what the revolutionary spirit is. It's a new beginning, a new order, and that's what she says, celebrates. So in the end, you know, I end this book that I think the deepest theme in Arendt is to take responsibility for our own kind of political lives. She would never give in to despair, to cynicism, to a logic of history. There's nothing that can be done. And to being a mere spectator, there is always the possibility. She's not afraid to speak about it as a miracle, because you can't always predict why it is how people come together.
What do you call it, contingency?
Yes,
or something.
But that people can, that there are those moments.
Yeah.
And that's what she sees. I mean, that's why she says, you know, she sees it in the revolution, she sees it in the Paris Commune, she saw it in Budapest
in Hungary,
again.
You write about this.
People spontaneously coming together and really exercise, not only simply exercise, but demanding and engaging in a kind of freedom.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, this kind of spontaneity and natality, you said much earlier in teaching, that people can be activated and they have this capacity which is asleep in us, and sort of what you said, it's a second being.
Before, I was interested in Arendt. You know, I've been around for a long time. I mentioned to you earlier that I taught at Yale. I went to Yale during the McCarthy period, you know, and it was a little bit horrifying because even then at Yale, most people were sympathetic with McCarthy. I couldn't believe it.
Most people were sympathetic with McCarthy.
Young students.
Where now we have historical
This is William Buckley had just graduated, and he wrote this, and I went to a debate in which he was there, and the audience was cheering him, and he was defending McCarthy. And you had the conception. And in the later 50s, I mean, you know, Eisenhower year, people had no interest in. Then you saw the beginnings of the student movement, opposing the House on American Activities, the Hollywood 10. And I was there, witnessed that whole period. In fact, I was in Mississippi myself in 1964. Okay. Now, Arendt certainly was a great fan of the early civil rights movement. But that exemplified the idea of people getting off their fannies, deciding to do something, acting together, and making a difference. And that was classically Arendtian.
But I actually think this is quite interesting when you see her and read accounts of her teaching.
Yeah.
She really cared about what students said. And as dismissive or impatient she could be with people who were stupid. Victor Ehrlich told me this anecdote. When she was at Yale, someone asked a question, and she said, next.
Yeah.
She said didn't have time for the question.
No, I mean, if you read, particularly if you read her reading her correspondence is really... This is a lost art, you know. This is the last generation of people who really wrote letters.
Right.
And what's fascinating, we have now published the letters to her husband, the letters to Heidegger, the letters to Mary McCarthy, and what I think is the most important collection, the letters to Jaspers.
Jaspers, right.
And you see the complexity of... Sometimes you think you're reading a slightly different person in the way she...
Right. And she was also complex in these relationships
with
all these people.
But in that, she's also very revealing about who she likes and who she doesn't, who she thinks is stupid and who she doesn't. You know, sometimes it can be almost, not embarrassing, but very revealing.
But if you said at the end of the 50s, so you're in the mid-50s, and then you see the student movement is actually generating new ideas.
Yes.
And I think what you said, natality, spontaneity, newness... Yeah. If you think about today's America, where people are turning to Arendt, I'm a little cautious to think, let's turn to these books that give us guidance. Arendt would have said, invent your own new ways of doing it.
I think she would.
She never,
in fact, at that first conference, there was a whole discussion of theory and practice, and people were arguing that we theoreticians should have to give blueprints of direction.
Right.
And she resisted that. the thing. She really did that. It only has to come. I mean, in some ways, she's a great defender of participants deciding the wrong kind of thing. But where I think it is relevant, you cannot turn to Arendt for solutions. You can't turn to her, well, I'm going to read her and then I'm going to know what to do. But you can turn to her for illumination because it is an argument. I mean, she begins the origins by saying, progress and doom are two sides of the same coin. They're both superstitions. So she didn't believe in inevitable progress, but she also would reject something which I think is becoming very fashionable. The system is so corrupt. Right. Things are so awful, there is nothing that can be done. Yeah, right. She would resist that.
Right.
That is, you know, a kind of violation of our capacity to begin something new.
And there's something, I think, when you read the letters and the things, the excitement she has by discovering a new idea.
Yeah.
There's a sort of, what you said, your first conversation was from 8 till 2, and they said there was an erotic charge. You see, there's an excitement. And
all the encounters I had were memorable. I mean, the other thing that I find always perplexing, people sometimes say, well, she's cold, she's too rational. If there was, to me, an example of a passionate thinker and a person who loved and wanted to argue about ideas, it was clearly Arendt. That's the way in which we encountered each other.
Yeah.
So even on a technical issue, how to translate Geist, you know, we went back and forth on this.
Right, I like the fact that you end the book on the councils during the Hungarian Revolution, which is kind of spontaneous, small kind of collective action.
Well, that's, I mean, one of our favorite phrases was islands of freedom.
Islands of freedom.
Freedom. And I also think that's very important today in terms of at least getting some illumination. Sometimes, you know, if we go back, she didn't live to see the solidarity movement. I think she would have been very, I mean, after all, that's paradigmatic. Well, first of all, Adam Michnik, who was one of the leaders of Solidarity, was reading Hannah Arendt when he's in prison and was inspired by it.
Okay.
Because why is it inspiring? Because power can grow. Empowerment can grow.
Okay.
People talking around.
Yeah.
And it is the Velvet Revolution started by people sitting around kitchen tables talking.
Yeah, right.
You know, and
then it
grows. And I think that is a message which I think is important for young people. You know, if you're going to say, how are we going to change the system? How are we going to change it?
Right.
That's the wrong way to think. But talk, but in but small
it's,
ways.
Yeah, it's the same the civil rights movement. It's in churches, in living rooms, in community centers.
Well, I think that's, and you never know, it can fail. There's no guarantee of success.
Right.
But this is the way, I think, the revolutionary movements begin.
Yeah.
In her sense of revolution, the revolutionary spirit.
Right.
Which you wanted to keep alive.
With no guarantee, right?
Yes, no guarantee.
I like that. Yeah, you wrote an essay, I think, there. You quoted her, the thinking without a banister. There are no guardrails.
Well, that, I think, is tremendously important for her. I mean, and it's part of a larger thing, I think, in the 20th century that you have. I mean, we want guardrails. We want crutches. We want foundations. If we don't have that, anything goes.
Right.
And that's a rent to sow against both extremes. That's what thinking without banisters is.
I think I want to thank you.
Okay, good.
This has been really fun. And
you can see if I start get talking, I don't stop.
We could go on for another. So if I may have you back sometime from 8 till 2 or something like that. We wouldn't have done justice to Arendt in an
perfect.
Hour or so.
It's perfect.
Thank you so much.